Reel two.
Reel two.
As I say, on the underground, people would spend night after night there, huddled up in blankets, sleeping bags and so on, and there was plenty of work to do there from the sort of social point of view, and also dealing with minor injuries, minor illnesses, because the medical services, civilian medical services, were very, very stretched at that time. So we survived the Blitz anyway, and I think after that, I was then, we'd got to about camp number 12 up in Birmingham, and having become such a competent cook, I was sent up to camp 12 to instruct other people in the gentle art of cooking 1,000 sausages at once and so on. So I spent my time at the 12th camp, which must have been in 1941, late 41, middle of 41, as a cook instructor. Now, it was at that time, I think, that the unit was looking into the possibilities of work outside Europe, looking for work with the army in North Africa, in China, in Syria. In fact, the world had suddenly become our oyster. And it was then, I think, that the idea of trying to get together a group to go out to Ethiopia to try and not rescue, it isn't quite the right word, but to try and perpetuate the very excellent medical services that the Italians, for all their faults, had set up in Ethiopia. Whatever one might think about the invasion of a state like Ethiopia by the Italians, there's no doubt that the Italians, while they were there, did two tremendous things. They built most superb roads and got communications going, and they set up a superb countrywide medical service, which the inhabitants of Ethiopia had never before ever had in their lives. They'd had the odd missionary who'd go out to treat them and so on, but the Italians set up outpatient clinics, they built hospitals. If you read the Italian version of the history of the invasion and the occupation of Ethiopia, even allowing for their exaggeration as to what they did, it's quite obvious, and we saw it for ourselves, that they had done a tremendous lot for them. The emperor, of course, thought otherwise.
Yes, did he come into the picture at this stage, you know, when the idea was being mooted?
He may have done, I'm not sure. Just cleared up how the idea of going there came up. But I know it did come up, and in at that time we were so well organised, sort of internally, that there was a newsletter which would emanate from Gordon Square headquarters and go round to the various groups all over the country. And I saw in that it was planned that a group of about 40 men would be chosen, or were being chosen, to go to Ethiopia to help keep the medical services going. And then I discovered just by talking to people at the camp, that quite a number of my friends had already been interviewed and been chosen to go. I thought, well, right, mine will come any day, but it didn't. So I phoned them up at Gordon Square, went to see them, and I said, look, this Ethiopian party, this sounds like something really worthwhile doing. I'm a cook instructor at the camp. Am I going to stay teaching people to cook for the rest of the war, or am I going to have the opportunity of going out and doing something really worthwhile? And they said, oh, Norman, you know, I think we really do need cook instructors as far as we... but we take your point. And to cut a long story short, they said, right, we'll fit you in. So I really put myself into the Ethiopian convoy. And as events turned out, was one of the first to reach the country. There was a lot of negotiation that had to go on between the Ethiopian government, which in those days was a bit of a chaotic organisation, and the War Office, and the troop movement section of the War Office. Trying to get anybody anywhere in those days was extremely difficult. There was a thing called movement control, which was run by the Navy and the Army, I think, and everybody had to know where everyone else was going, quite obviously. So we had tremendous difficulty not only in getting the idea of a party of 40 conscientious objectors going to what was then a relatively unknown quantity. After all, we called it Abyssinia then. There was this unknown quantity of chaps. There was difficulty in getting the Ethiopian government, A, to agree, and B, to make arrangements for us to stay somewhere when we got there. And negotiations dragged on for month after month. Anyhow, finally, I think it was in early 1942, I think April, we all more or less set off, not quite together, but within a few days. The bulk of the party went from Liverpool on a troop ship. Others went from Glasgow, Gourock or somewhere, and I and five others, we had to split up these parties simply because there was not enough space on the troop ship for these odd people, these unit chaps. So as it happened, I went with five others on a small freight steamer from Bristol, I remember.
Before I ask you about the journey, or before you tell me, did you have special training in England?
Oh, we did. You left? And you know jolly well because you looked at the book. Yes, I've forgotten that, haven't I? Yes, has that gone on? Oh, dear. Yes, it wasn't just a question of taking 40 people out of the hat, saying, right, you'll go to Ethiopia. We realised there would be special problems there, and that the first aid training we'd had in the camps wouldn't be sufficient. And so it was arranged that we would spend many days in, I think it was called Livingston College. This was a missionary medical college out in the East End somewhere, in Leytonstone, I believe. And we went, I think we lived there, a group of us, not all of us, but certainly a group, perhaps there were two parties. And there we were taught a lot of interesting medical stuff about malaria and venereal disease and hookworm and all the other things that we were expected to meet. We had a very good teacher, a retired missionary, and this is where most of our primitive medicine was learnt, in Livingston College. Additionally, we knew we'd have to learn something of the language. And the Ethiopian language, it has its own alphabet. I found it quite difficult to learn. In the event, we found that all the work we had put into learning Amharic, which is the Ethiopian language, was largely wasted, because after, I forget how many years, of Italian occupation, Italian, which is an easy language to learn, was spoken by very many of the Ethiopians themselves. So I found I never had to use what little Amharic I knew. With a reasonable working knowledge of French, which is easily, which is related, of course, being Latin to the Italian language, one could get by with a kind of pidgin Italian. So all our work with Amharic was, I think, rather a waste of time. I found it very difficult, particularly the script, but some people got on with it remarkably well, and of course that was made use of by them and by the Ethiopian government to help out on the sort of teaching shortage. It was a very good thing. So there was a specialist training to going to Ethiopia. As I say, we didn't all leave England together. The main party left from Liverpool, but had an unfortunate episode. The ship broke down, and they were desperately delayed. And the first people to arrive there were six of us, who travelled out in a convoy, for the most part, in a small freight steamer, which we discovered afterwards was... They were discovered during the course of the voyage was loaded with explosives, because someone had said, what's that coloured flag up at the top there? And one of the sailors said, oh, it's because we've got these explosives on board. We then had earnest discussions about whether pacifists should accept the protection of the anti-aircraft guns which this freighter carried, and whether we should decline to go out on the ship at all. But when it was pointed out that if we didn't go out on the ship, we wouldn't get out anyway, most of us, I think, accepted the fact that in wartime this kind of thing had to be accepted, as we were not asked to take turns with the anti-aircraft gun anyway. It became really an academic point. Anyhow, it was a very long voyage out because we had to go via the Cape, and I think when we had to go round the Cape and up to the Red Sea and land in Aden, where the army had got its messages slightly tangled up, and where the ports officer there was expecting six Quaker women, Quaker missionaries. Instead of that, he had these six rather interesting lot of chaps. Anyhow, from Aden we crossed the Red Sea in a filthy little tub of a boat, and then there was an excellent train which runs, still does, from Asmara on the coast there right up to Addis Ababa. This was a train which had been put in by the Italians, of course. And this was a sort of, I think, a day's journey in the train, I can't remember. Anyhow, we arrived in Addis Ababa, the six of us, with nowhere to go, no one expecting us. However, there was an hotel there at that time, and probably still is, the Imperial Hotel. So we felt all we could do, in the absence of any official instruction from London as to what we were to do, we moved en bloc into this hotel and waited for the others to arrive. And how eventually everyone did arrive, and we had a headquarters provided for us by the Ethiopians. We were moved out of the hotel because it was an expensive business. And we established a headquarters in Addis Ababa, from where we were sent from time to time to the outpatient clinics dotted around the country, clinics which had been set up by the Italians and which were now unstaffed except by trained Ethiopian dressers, as they were called, whereas previously each clinic dotted around the country was run by an Italian doctor who had trained dressers to deal with the more elementary things. And some of these clinics had operating theatre facilities, small theatres attached to them. So there had been a very high standard of medical treatment there. And from the word go, those of us who were put out to these clinics, usually we went in twos or threes, but ultimately some of us found I was the only person there. And I can't remember how many months I spent at Ambo, which was a clinic some 80 miles to the west of Addis Ababa. But I know it seemed a very long time, because weeks would go by before I'd see anyone from Addis or even get any post. So one was very much out on a limb.
Could you give me some idea of what the country was like? You know, first of all, Addis Ababa when you arrived, and then going out into this clinic. What sort of terrain was it?
Well, the country is mountainous. The country sits on a great plateau, and although it's on the equator, virtually, as it's about 8,000 feet above sea level, it has cold nights and days. It's a fairly healthy climate, really. But very mountainous, especially to the north. Only when you get down to the east, you get down to the plain, do you get the typical sort of tropical climate. We'd gone out, incidentally, fully sort of versed in anti-malarial prophylaxis, but in fact there was no need for it. There's no, as I recall, very little malaria up on the mountainous areas, and only down on the plains. And we'd even been provided with pith helmets, of the sort of Boer War type, you know, to protect us from the sun. We never wore them, of course. We never wore them. We wore official Red Cross uniform, Slightly adapted, as I recall. There was an epaulette we'd had made which said Friends Ambulance Unit under the Red Cross, but basically it was a Red Cross uniform, shorts and khaki shirts and so on. And it was a climate which any European can fit into quite happily. The people were extremely interesting. If you look at the pictures on television today, they do not look any different from what they looked 40 years ago. Everyone goes around in this sort of wrapped around sheet, the name of which escapes me at the moment. But it's a very primitive dress, because they were and still are a very primitive people. And the interesting thing was that the same sort of troubles that you read of today were certainly there when we were there. Up in the north towards Gondar, there were always stories coming down of brigands, highway robbers and so on, and inter-tribal warfare. That was still going on. It was going on then and still goes on today. We didn't see, and I think I'm right in this, we did not see any severe hunger. That's the one thing that seems to be different today. I think those of us who were well out into the country never saw famine, not even on a small scale. Okay, people were, very often you'd find people just desperately undernourished, but you never saw large-scale famine. Communication wasn't particularly good. There was a telephone service of sorts. There was quite a good bus service more or less throughout the country, but it ran erratically. We had to rely on commercial transport, and there were plenty of those. Quite a lot of Italians had stayed behind when the Italian army of occupation was driven out. A lot of Italian civilians opted to remain behind. In fact, the country couldn't have done without them, because the Italian civilians were responsible for the electricity, for the telephone, for the buses, for the trains. If they'd swept all the Italians out of Ethiopia, it would have just have gone back to being the primitive country it was before the Italians took it over. And the Italians that were responsible for commercial transport were a very helpful bunch, and this is how we got to the various places we got to, because we did not have our own transport. We might have had one car or two cars perhaps in Addis Ababa, but we did not have a unit transport as such. We had to rely on commercial sources, and this we had to rely on that too for post, because the postal service wasn't particularly good. And the telephone would work perhaps one day and not the next. In any case, there were not domestic telephones as such. You had to go to a telegraph office and hopefully get through to Addis Ababa from wherever you were. Now, we did take with us, of course, and I should have mentioned this right at the beginning, we did take with us, I think, half a dozen fully qualified doctors. One, two, three, yes, about half a dozen. And they were used to set us up in the various clinics and hospitals that we worked in. For example, when I went to Ambo, I went with Dr. Husband, and he sat in with me on these various clinics. We saw the sort of things that we would have to treat, and when he was happy that I could cope, he'd leave me to it, and off he'd go somewhere else. And from time to time, he would visit, and I'd line up various things for him which needed his particular skills. He was a surgeon, as it happened, and I remember we operated successfully on the headmaster's son from the school in Ambo, and we operated on him on my dining room table, because there was no theatre as such in this and whatnot. I gave the anaesthetic, and Tony did. This was an operation on his sinuses, I recall. And I was surprised that he would be prepared to operate in these relatively primitive conditions, but Tony would operate anywhere. He subsequently went down to a biggish hospital about another 100 miles west in Lekempti, that really was in the backyard. And there he did tremendous work, not only dealing with relatively simple things like these enormous hernias that people got, but he did a lot of work with children who'd been crippled with poliomyelitis. and subsequently after the war went on to the Sudan to do equally good work there.
Well, would the FAU have been the only medical service in Ethiopia, you know, leaving apart the Italians?
Yeah, there was a Department of Health, an Ethiopian Department of Health. But with all due respect to those who were running it then, I think we could say this was only a Department of Health in name. I don't think they had any really properly trained public health personnel, and certainly I don't recall meeting any Ethiopian doctors. There were certainly no Italian doctors, of course, they'd all gone back home. So at that time, I suppose there must have been one or two. Whether they were qualified or not, I don't know. But it seems to us, looking back, in hindsight, that the doctors we took with us were about the only doctors we had in the country at the time. Now it's coming to me. We didn't have Ethiopian doctors, trained Ethiopian doctors, as I can recall, but we did have quite a few European doctors. You can imagine a country like Ethiopia tends to attract people who perhaps need to get away from their countries because of persecution and others. And there were Armenians, there were Greeks, there were Russians. One or two dotted here and there. I seem to recall a very good dentist in Addis Ababa. I think he was Armenian or Turkish. But there certainly were other Europeans who were there before the Italian invasion, possibly, and had stayed through it and stayed on afterwards and had got established practices. Yes, there must have been. Our doctors were not the only doctors. They couldn't have been, but we were certainly outnumbered the others.
Yes, I was wondering also about the army, the British army. Did they have...
They'd all gone by then. They didn't leave any of their medical people behind at all. When I say the British army had gone, that's not quite true. There was, up in Gondar, there was a... Not a regiment, not a... I don't know what it was. A company. A company is only a small number of people, isn't it? 12 or something. Let's say a group, anyway. There was a static group, army group, up in Gondar, who were left behind by the British just to keep an eye on things, and there were probably a few still in Addis Ababa, but they were very low key. Their presence was hardly noticed. And up in Gondar, we got on with them very well. We had, you know, socially, we got on very well with them. But whether they had their own medics, I just cannot recall. This is too far back. I didn't spend a great deal of time in Gondar. The only time I spent there was on the way home. We had to spend about 6 weeks there while we were organising transport up to Cairo to get back home. But I do remember that the colonel there in charge was a great guy, and we got on very well with him indeed, both socially and I don't know whether we discussed pacifist ideas with them or not. I don't think we did. I think we played bridge mainly with them. But all the contacts I'd had with the army during the war were almost always most pleasant. When we didn't know whether we were going to Ethiopia or not, but we thought we might be going to North Africa or somewhere where we'd be helping with the Army Medical Corps, we were sent off, a batch of us, about 30 of us, were sent off to, I think it was a Rimi section up in Cambridge, and we stayed in a little cafe there. We spent days actually working physically with this army unit. They thought we were a queer lot, didn't quite know how to take us, because again we were in Red Cross uniform, rough khaki uniform. They didn't know quite how to take us, but we sat down with them all to Christmas dinner, I remember. This is when the officers served the men, and we sat down with the men, and a good time was had by all. There was never any animosity towards us, and I've never met this. And on the boat going out, of course, one met the merchant seamen, and they knew who we were and what we were, but there was never any unpleasantness or any feeling that we were queer or outcast, queer in the old sense of the word, queer or outcast or anything like that. And certainly in Ethiopia, and this is true on the troop ships too, most of us came back on a troop ship, we loaded up in Cairo, and we were just accepted as people who'd been overseas and were going back to Blighty. Never met any antagonism or any... came up with any unpleasant arguments with any military or naval personnel whatsoever.
It would seem from what you said, though, that am I right in thinking that the FAU would have been the only medical service in Ethiopia?
It was the only effective medical service in Ethiopia. There was a medical service as such. There was nothing akin to our National Health Service, of course. But the Italians had set up virtually a National Health Service in that they offered their treatment in these outlying clinics to the Ethiopians for free. They didn't have to pay anything. How the whole thing was funded, I wouldn't know. But there was no... this wasn't a private enterprise of the Italians. This was a national enterprise. It was in their own interest to do this, of course, because disease was rife in Ethiopia. I mean, the place is riddled with venereal disease, probably still is. We saw more syphilis and gonorrhea in Ethiopia than I think the average venereologist would see in a lifetime here. And the most advanced syphilis.
Is that because... are the people promiscuous then? I wonder what the reason for that would be.
Ah, good question. I don't know that they're promiscuous per se. I think possibly they're just an unhygienic lot. And I think that the treponema, the syphilitic parasite, the syphilitic bacterium, Treponema pallidum, just flourishes in that climate and those sort of conditions. I mean, people slept on floors. Maybe, I'm sure, probably there was incest, there was promiscuity. But I know syphilis was absolutely rife. Almost every other person got it. And the most horrendous, because if you don't treat syphilis, you get the most horrendous effects. Oddly enough, we didn't see the neurological effects of syphilis, which is to drive people insane. You've heard of general paralysis of the insane, perhaps, which is a thing we used to see in this country before the introduction of mercury and the treatment of syphilis. And we didn't see it in Ethiopia. I don't know why this was so, but we did see the other manifestations of the third stage of syphilis, these huge sores on legs and thighs and faces and rotting bones and heaven knows what. It was the most horrendous. I got some superb pictures of all this, of course. The other thing one saw a little bit of in the mountains was malaria, but we saw a lot of tick fever. All the tropical diseases we've been taught to treat, we saw and treated reasonably successfully. But I suppose most of our treatment was the treatment of relatively simple things like chest diseases, tropical ulcers. These are big ulcers which appear on the legs. And syphilis, we could treat syphilis very effectively because we took out with us, not penicillin, but there wasn't any to spare then, but the arsenical drugs, which we happily stuck into people without doing too much damage. And the other things we treated a lot of course, were the gut parasites. There was plenty of worm killer, tapeworm, roundworm, you name it, they'd all got it. And it's just overwhelming, really. I mean, almost every patient coming to the clinic, if you took a routine test for roundworm, they'd got it. So there was never, ever a shortage of work.
How about...
Some of us, of course, did teaching. Tom Barnes, as he probably told you, was in charge at one time in Ezawa in a leper colony. Some of us who got on very well with Amharic... helped out with teaching in Addis Ababa schools. So it wasn't just all medical work, but 90% of our work was medical and surgical.
How did you assess the training you'd had for Ethiopia, you know, for the work you had to do? Now, were you well prepared?
Well prepared. Not only... we were well prepared by the training, and then we were guided and advised and pointed in the right direction, and our training finished off, as it were, not you could ever finish off a training, by the doctors we took with us, who incidentally, of course, were all members of the unit and therefore all pacifists.